You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Hello everybody, welcome to the Scottish Poetry Library podcast. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode, and we've got Miriam Gamble on the podcast today, and she's talking about her new collection, Pirate Music. Miriam Gamble is a poet I've been interested in for many years. We're all really excited about her latest collection from Blood Axe. Here she is talking about it.
Miriam Gamble.
Can we start the podcast with a poem from your first collection?
My partner, who's smarter than me, told me off for the way that I use semicolons, and that's kind of where, because I was, to be fair to him, using them incorrectly, because I was sort of using them as musical notation rather than in a grammatical way. And so that's where it came from, and partly also from the fact that the semicolon in an emoticon looks either like it's crying or winking. So semicolon. You criticize my use of the semicolon. I, bridled, take offense. There it is, huddled between us still like a boundary line. Two parts of the same sentence are riven by it, or it mingles sentences, self-sealed, that share something in common. Winker, weeper, sat on the fence. It's articulate of all that's ill-defined.
I'm wondering, when because you even titled, you didn't title it semicolon, you just used the punctuation. As a pretty bold choice there. Were people like, hey, you should, punctuation is not a title?
I kind of wanted the visual aspect of it because the poem is sort of about, you know, is half about what it looks like, or some of it is about what it looks like. So it just seemed the right thing to do, and nobody ever said anything about it. No, I didn't really think of it as being particularly bold.
I was reading today, and maybe this ties into some of it. You're into the idea that the poem is the thing, right? So you didn't write this poem and go, wow, that was good. I should do a colon poem. I should do a full stop poem. I should do what other weird bits of punctuation, brackets, you know, this kind of thing. That's not how you seem to write. You're into the making a good poem and then seeing if they collect into a book, right?
Yeah, I think that's an astute observation. I really envy people who can write sequences, and I suppose I've tried. Often something will come to me and I'll do a poem and then I'll think, I can see the potential for, or I'll, before I've done the poem, I'll see the potential for lots of different poems, and then I do one and I think, oh, that kind of covers it, you know? I'm not very, I mean, I don't know whether it's an Irish thing as well. The short lyric is what I seem to do, and I wish I could be more expansive sometimes, and I wish I could kind of set myself projects, but I don't, setting myself a project doesn't work for me, you know. It's not how I write. I wish I could, it would make life easier, but it's not the way it goes for me. There's a poem actually in the manuscript of the second book called The Animal Room, which is a prose poem, the only prose poem I've ever written successfully, at least I hope it's successful, but the idea started with the extinct animals room in the Kelvin Grove Museum in Glasgow, and I thought, I'll write all of these poems about animals that are extinct or animals that might be extinct, or, you know, or a whole pile of animals that we might never think would become extinct. And then I just ended up with this one poem which assumed that all animals have become extinct and is kind of weirdly set in the future, and that was it, you know. So again, same thing happened, you know.
Do you think it's because you're not able to hold back, that everything gets crammed into the one, like everything that you want to say gets crammed into the one, and then it's harder to get the second one or the third one in the sequence out, you know what I mean?
It's not the case that, you know, because often my poems are not very long, and also poems for me are not necessarily things where I start with a series of things to say and say them. I think I'm more of the Muldoon camp of the poem kind of goes somewhere and you have to let it go where it chooses to go, and that may mean that it doesn't do the things that you thought it might do. It does something else, and you have to respect what it has done and leave it alone. To me, it would feel programmatic, you know, to sit down and try, and I don't know whether that's maybe a wrong view, because you don't know where, if you have a basic idea from which a lot of poems might spring, you don't actually know where that basic idea is going to take you in different instances. It might take you in lots of different and bizarre and unexpected places, but I often feel when I've done one, I think, oh, right, okay, that's the vein is mind, you know. That's the best way I can put it, you know. And I would be committing a fraudulence if I then sat down and tried to spin a whole pile more poems out of it. You know, I mean, there are, in the second book, there's a there are a few poems about Wales, all of which were written close together, and they respond to the book Leviathan by Philip Hoare, and they respond to particular narratives or incidents that are in that book. But that's a newish thing for me, and even the whale poems, they're not a sequence, you know, they're put together in the book, but they're not a sequence as such, they're separate.
But I think it's really interesting, and I think the other interesting thing about it is, as I guess, because what I guess the way you work, what that allows for is, I guess your subconscious does some of the work, or your natural concerns begins to do some of the work. So it's interesting that you bring up extinct animals and whales.
The title poem is a whale poem. This one's called Pirate Music. The thing behind it is a narrative in Philip Hoare's book where he talks about a whale that had a kind of different sonar level from all of the other whales in its so it could hear other ones, but they couldn't hear it, and so it was sort of on its own. For it was tracked by scientists for 10 years swimming about on its own with no peers or no social interaction with other whales because they couldn't hear its call. Pirate Music. For 10 plus years they monitor the call, deepening and desperate, off range of a whale believed to be the only one of its kind. No other marks his particular rhythms. With timbre and timing out of sync, he is doomed to understand and not to be understood. In waters darker than the devil's blood, he exists, porous and piratical. His temperament, which once was good, soured from the endless lonely nights and vacant days. O fish softly skinned, O mammal. Where he sings, adamant, tremolo, of works not shown to man. Turn the dial, he is in your neighborhood, and this is not a parable.
What is it that attracts you to getting inside the heads of these creatures, I guess?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't suppose that I really consider that a poem in which I have got inside the head or something, because it's looking at it from the outside. It's talking about it, you know. I'm interested in the otherness of animals. I think that's at the root of what I'm interested in. For me, part of writing is about the inability to communicate as well, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why I write poems, is that I'm not necessarily a brilliant communicator, and it's not like they fill that hole for me where partly they're about. You know, so the epigraph to my first book is from an Ian Crichton Smith story, and what, after all, could I have done for him, even if I had been able to communicate with him? You know, there are a few love poems in the first book that are sort of rooted in that inability to get past, you know, to ever know what's going on in somebody else's mind, and to ever communicate to somebody else what's going on in yours. And I suppose that, you know, that's in the animal poems as well. Part of this also, I think, was slightly responding to what seemed to me probably unfairly, like the cruelty of the voyeurism of people just tracking this whale for 10 years when they couldn't do anything about it and they weren't going to, you know, because naturalists and scientists who are involved with the natural world don't intervene, you know, what could they do anyway, you know? But it seemed to me a sort of macabrely voyeuristic, you know, that they would pursue it and try, you know, make notes about it and write up a scientific study about it. And I think Hoare is a literary nonfiction writer who writes brilliantly, giving you those details, but bringing the extra thing that an imaginative engagement with something can give you, and that's kind of what we hope poems will do. I don't believe in poetry as polemic or in the value of clear statements like that, and so what I hope I've done is do something a little bit more complex than that, you know, to being able to, I don't believe in poetry that pass, or in my poetry passing judgment really, you know, or in any kind of straightforward way. I don't think that's what it's for, what it's there for. It's there to explore, you know.
Yeah, I guess that goes back to the idea of writing a poem without trying to say something as well, without necessarily the agenda to say this is going to be a poem about death. This is going to be this kind of thing, right? It's not about saying this meat is murder, right? Like,
yeah,
that would be. When did you realize that you had a book? When did you realize that pirate music was pirate music?
Come from a poetic culture in Northern Ireland where big things have had to be handled, not by, you know, not necessarily by my generation, although we've come in the wake of people who wrote these big poems about big things. And, you know, so there's always been that nervousness in the back of my mind that, you know, or a, not a lack of freedom, but a sense of poetry needing to live up to something, I guess, you know. And I think with this book, I wanted it to be, without necessarily being able to define what that is, a little bit more political than the last one, and a bit more, poetry is not a place for the black and white. Okay, it's black print on a white page, but, you know, that's about as black and white as it should get, I think. And
no, I think that, like, you know, because I was reading today about you, and I did, somewhere they said Miriam's part of the ceasefire generation of poets.
Yeah, post-ceasefire. Is
maybe post-ceasefire.
I suppose, I mean, I think it's weird for me to feel that because I've always, I mean, these categories are just categories anyway, you know, and they're critical tools rather than necessarily perhaps accurate representations of you know, it's like anybody representing in saying that there's a school of poetry, or that, you know, that it sort of obviates the individuality of the things that different people are doing. But I think of that as being kind of Alan Gillis, Leontia Flynn, Sinead Morrissey, and then me and my mate Owen Wall sort of floating about somewhere in the, after that, you know. But I suppose that's, you know, really there's, you know, there's not a huge time gap between, say, us and those people. They're more established and they've published more, you know. And but I, because I write criticism as well, I've written post-ceasefire Northern Irish poetry criticism, and for me, it, you know, I have written about them in that way, and not really factored myself into, well, you know, nobody's going to write criticism by themselves, you know. But
was that a label based on the work, or is it based on strictly timeline of birth?
It's not a label. It's not a label. You know, there is a label in Northern Ireland that troubles trash, you know, that is stuff that just sort of feeds off, you know. I mean, I think there's always been a sort of anxiety in Northern Ireland that's been perpetuated there, and also from outside, you know, would this amazing burst of poetry have happened if it hadn't been for the troubles, you know? And that's not really a question worth asking. The question worth asking is, how did the poetry that we value handle this situation, you know, or respond? Or to me, to be posing that question in relation to Seamus Heaney, to Michael Longley, to Kieran Carson, to Maeve McGuckian, to Derek Mahon, to Paul Muldoon, you know, is pointless. It's, you know, we should be grateful for the poetry that ensued and not ask whether they wouldn't have written it, or, you know, well, they would have written something different, you know, probably, but that's kind of a dead end to me as a line of inquiry, you know.
I was wondering, how does that affect your own output? How does that affect your own writing? Like, to be so aware of what's happened, what has been happening, what other people have done, and then to try to put something new in the world.
At the moment, there's a time tension because I have to do so much of it that there is very little room for me to think creatively, both in terms of time, you know, just my own work is crowded out at the moment, but... And in terms of reviewing and writing criticism, I mean, I haven't written an awful lot of academic criticism. I do a reasonable amount of reviewing, but I don't think I ever come to, you know, when I come to sit down and try and write a poem, those things that I would identify in the work of others are not in my head, really, you know, that they're... I don't know whether that's the same for everybody that does both, or whether it's... a kind of coin of fortune for me that it doesn't, you know, I'm sure it's there subconsciously, but it's not sitting in my head, you know. Formal questions, for example, aren't really present in my mind whenever I'm trying to put a poem together in a sort of conscious way. I mean, I think, yeah, you know, sometimes you have an idea for something or you write a poem and you think it's like the most original thing in the world, and then you read another poem by somebody else and you're like, ah, okay. So I'm not the only person who thought of doing this. Right, okay. But, you know, that's, or of taking this, you know, particular type of approach to something or whatever, you know, but that's not related to writing criticism. It's just related to reading, you know, and I suppose it's something you become more aware of the older you get and the more you read, you know, that actually most shit's been done before, you know, and that that's not actually necessarily where originality resides anyway. You know, originality doesn't necessarily reside in subject matter or because the novelty of poetry is not what you choose to address in it, you know, because, hey, some other people in the course of history have written poems about animals, you know, and some other people in the course of history have written poems about love and, you know, consumerism and the sea and whatever else, you know, and I don't really want to spend my life reading poems about mobile phones just because, you know, that's something new that, you know, which is not to say that mobile phones shouldn't be in poems because that's not what I'm saying, but, you know, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the mark of the originality of your work is not based in how daring your subject matter is or how you wrote about something that nobody else ever wrote about before, or, you know, I'm not sure where it does reside, but I don't think it resides there. You know?
Yeah, because I sometimes will talk to students or younger people who are just starting out, and oddly, the ones that have read a lot and are really passionate about certain things, I find have a really hard time starting because they get caught in that feedback loop of wanting their work to be as good as Michael Longley.
Bishop, right? Yeah. Yeah.
You're not gonna do it, but you'll be fine. But yeah.
A useful naivety can be, you know, can be protective for people of not realizing that, you know, certain things have happened before or, but I think that falls away from everybody, you know, the question of influence has always confused me a little bit, you know, because I suppose, you know, there are one or two people that I maybe had to wrestle with a bit But that sort of gargantuan struggle with the predecessor doesn't. I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's couched in as a kind of male thing anyway. But I suppose that's a critical construct as well. You know, the idea of the poet doing battle with somebody and then eventually flinging them out of the ring and proceeding with their own original voice. You know, I just don't. I mean, you have to watch. You know, if you've been reading a lot of somebody, maybe, you know, and you try to. But I mean, God, everybody knows. You know, if you pick up. I remember doing that last year. I was teaching Thomas Tranströmer, and I picked up, you know, decided to try and write a poem, and it just sounded like a Thomas Tranströmer poem. So I just chucked it out because it was, you know, because it wasn't my voice. Just because I'd been immersed in somebody else's work, and their patterns of perception and rhythms and so on were in my head. You know, but everybody can recognize when the poem they've written is not their poem, but, you know, a kind of pale imitation of somebody else's, you know. So can you
tell me a little bit about just working with images, actually, because that was something that, are there any poems in the new collection in Pirate Music that address an image of any sort?
Oh, paintings,
yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple. One of them is really long. It's the longest. Well, it's not real. For it's really long for me. It's like two sides of A4. It's probably an average poem for you. You know,
epic. It's an epic. Yeah.
But there is a shorter one, which is about a. it's about an artwork I saw in Australia, actually. A Durer woodcut. It was in an exhibition about death and pestilence and this type of thing, which obviously seemed like the perfect thing to go in and look at on a sunny day in Australia. But, you know, I really liked it, and I'd written something else which is kind of beforehand, which is playing with symbolism actually and sort of misperceptions of my fella's brother bought us a pair of mugs with Union Jacks on them, which for somebody from not, I mean, he's Scottish, and so partly that's, he just doesn't get, you know, how, but, you know, that's like buying a Northern Irish person, something like that, is just, you know, so these are items, what the hell are we going to do with those? Like, I can't have those in my house, you know? And, and then we just sort of, he's also, his brother is dyspraxic. So there are certain ways in which he, you know, he's just sees things differently. And so I wrote a poem about that, which is kind of addressing symbolic ways of seeing, because Northern Ireland is a symbol saturated place, you know, and I thought it was quite fun to look at it from the perspective of somebody who just didn't see like that at all and just wouldn't get that, you know, sense that a mug with a picture on it has some kind of huge, you know, cultural kind of taboo-ness also, you know. And so this is sort of doing similar things, because I saw this Dürer woodcut, which was like a guy in the street with death standing with a sort of hourglass, you know, presenting it to. In fact, I think I've got the book in here, but that's not, there's no point in that. It's an audio thing, but and the, you know, the guy's a sort of merchant. It's called Lansquenet and Death. So he's a mercenary soldier, and he's this big plume on his hat and these kind of ridiculous trousers and so on, and I just looked at it and thought, you know, because in medieval memento mori art, everybody knows what the symbols mean, you know, so you only have to, there are all these things with like death lurking about behind a tree, looking at lovers, and everybody looks at it and knows, reads a message into it. And I just thought it was funny to think about this in a kind of contemporary framework, whereby it would look like someone trying to sell something to somebody on the street, and or somebody, you know, and to just kind of reimagine it in that way. So that's what it does. It's a very long preamble for a not very long poem, which is kind of my style. So it's just named after the piece of art, Albrecht Dürer, Lansquenet and Death, 1510. Death, how do you do? Offers an hourglass to the mercenary. The mercenary doesn't want one. Not today. Not today, thanks all the same. But he's been caught off guard and has to hear him out. Death speaks in an impenetrable dialect. He raves of the past and future. The mercenary suspects he's addled with drugs. Where, aimlessly, did a guy like this get hold of a thing like that? The mercenary wonders, though. A lovely piece, true vintage if it's a day. And Death is speechless. His long jaw drags as the damned soul fumbles in a jacket pocket. Here, buy yourself a burger or something. Don't let me catch you here again.
That's a funny last line. You do work with paintings and images and etchings occasionally, and I think you're really good at getting into it but not doing it. I've read so many poems where people describe what they're seeing.
Yeah.
You know, which is the most frustrating thing. How do you work yourself out of that? How do you get around that desire to just be like, oh man, it's a really beautiful shade of blue?
Yeah, I mean, I think there, I'm really not much of an expert on visual art. If anything, you know, in poetry terms, you know, I've got a bit of background in music, but none really in, you know, in an art at all. But I agree with you, like, you know, poems that respond to paintings have to do something different, you know, because there is no, as well as anything else, you know, if you're going to come up with this poem that then is standing competing with, you know, is sort of just writing out what's in a painting, you know, and the painting obviously is going to be a good painting, you're like, okay, there's my poem kind of saying what's happening in a really superior artwork. I mean, I've not done it that often. There's a couple in the book. I worked with a painter as well on just a wee private project. I met him at a writers and artists retreat, and I liked his work and he liked mine, and so he was putting work together for an exhibition, and I wrote some poems to go along with the paintings. That was a different experience, because with the other ones, I've kind of, some things just caught my eye in the things. I mean, it starts out with, I really like that painting, and then, you know, then you have to think about what you might do, you know. But when I worked with Douglas, it was sort of, you know, the paintings got, I got sent photographs of the paintings, and then I had to just pick the ones that I would work with. And so that was a slightly different process, like I guess a commission would be, you know, where you're sort of, well, I need to think of, you know, it's perhaps a slightly more constructed process. I think you have to find a way of bringing something other to it. There's an absolutely fantastic poem about a painting, which is probably one of my favourite poems, full stop, by Ian Duig. It's called, it has two names, depending on where you see it, because he wrote it. It was part of a book that the Ulster Museum commissioned a range of poets to write responses to paintings that were in their collection, and he chose this really kind of cruddy, totally stereotype type painting of like, it's called Rustics Dancing Outside an Inn, and then just wrote this amazing, mad, but really canny and clever, historically situated poem, kind of claiming that the artist was giving two fingers to whoever had commissioned him to write it, or by putting in these weird details like baked hedgehogs on the roof of, and it's pitched during around the French Revolution, you know, and it's just absolutely superb. And what he's done is look very closely at what he sees and then just imagine what he wants to imagine into it, and so he sort of takes over it in a way, but it's, you know, it's fabulous.
I guess it comes down to not being confined by what's in the actual painting,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
like,
I mean,
not
if
being,
you look at this, you know, there is, by any stretch of, if you stretch your imagination, you can see the details that he's seeing, but you know, you can also see that he's imposing them on it, and also imposing the, you know, the story that he's read into it, onto it, and yeah, I think it's brilliant. It's in The Lammas Hireling, and also in this book that the Ulster Museum produced called A Conversation Piece. Recommend it very highly.
Thank you very much. Let's close the podcast with one last poem from the new book.
I don't know, you've been to Oz. Have you heard koalas?
They're loud and horrid. Sound. I have no idea.
Yeah, no, they are kind of loud and horrid. They sound, so while I was there, my friend took me for a couple of nights down the Great Ocean Road, so we stayed in this really beautiful beach house that belonged to her friend, and there were koalas just kind of in the trees up the back of it, and there's a sort of idyllic looking, you know, set up, but the noise they make is horrific. They sound like, you know, and they and they look so kind of cute and stupid, and you know, and so it's just, the poem's just based on the sort of bizarreness of this cute little furry thing having this horrendous voice. It's called The Brutality of Koala Song. Hairy little Don with the voice of a sex-starved maniac. Your foot hanging out of the gum when pressed should deliver a note of Augustan sweetness. It ought to be that you digress with well-meaning, absent-minded intent on subjects of a day that is thoroughly outdated. You ought to sport spectacles and a powdered wig. You balance your bum on the meanest twig and sleep all day, a twig that shouldn't hold you, your bulbous weight. Your curled ball is ridiculous to the sight. Who tutored you in this rapist's language, little clerk, little Dickensian notary? This bass guttural that rocks the forest canopy and that keeps me awake all night. Gorillas will deface each other, but you have snuff in your ears, you chew your poppies. You're a natural non sequitur. Honest, the hand that chose to paint you grey with just occasional daubs of black and white.
Miriam Gamble, everybody. The book is Pirate Music. It'll be out later this month. You can pre-order a copy now from Blood Axe Books, or hold tight, it'll be available at fine bookshops everywhere very, very soon, by the end of the month. Thank you so much to Miriam, and thank you for listening. We'll be back in your ears very, very soon. Until then, that's all for now.
This episode was produced by Colin Fraser of Culture Laser Productions for the Scottish Poetry Library.
Thank you for downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at By Leaves We Live, and find us on Facebook.